KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, February 10, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Today's speaker will be James Milliken, recently installed president of the University of Nebraska. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Chris Allen.
I'd like to welcome you to the Omaha Press Club. My name is Chris Allen. I'm from the University of Nebraska at Omaha School of Communication, and I'm also a member of the OPC Education Committee. And I have the pleasure of moderating this afternoon's Press Club Forum. Once a month, the Press Club, through its Education Committee, sponsors a forum of interest to club members and to the community at large. These forums are open to everyone. You do not have to be a member of the Press Club to attend, and I thank all of you for coming today. This is a nice turnout. Nebraska has traditionally been a state that is proud of its higher education. The University of Nebraska is an excellent institution. Each of its campuses provides a unique addition to the mix. Two of those campuses are here in Omaha, the University of Nebraska at Omaha and the University of Nebraska Medical Center. The universities in Lincoln and Kearney complete the picture. And yet, over the past decades, state support of higher education has begun to decrease, and this is not only in Nebraska, it's nationwide. There was a time in some states, Missouri I know, I don't know about Nebraska for sure, but I know in Missouri, where a student paid no tuition at all to attend the University of Missouri. In the 1930s, Missouri was tuition free. It was merely an extension of your K-12 education, and then if you wanted to, you would go on to the university. Those days are long past. They are no more. I recently heard someone say that state colleges have gone from state-funded to state-supported and soon maybe merely state-located. With all the other pressures on the state budget, including K-12 education and Medicaid, it's not hard to see why. Tax revenues are understandably limited. That's just one of the conditions that greeted our guest, James B. Milliken, when he returned to Nebraska last August to become the sixth president of the University of Nebraska system. J.B. Milliken grew up in Nebraska and graduated from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He earned a law degree from New York University and practiced law in New York before moving to Washington as a legislative assistant. Mr. Milliken returned to Nebraska and served as vice president for corporate affairs and corporation secretary for the NU system. He left that job in 1998 to become vice president for external affairs and university advancement for the University of North Carolina. Last year, the NU Board of Regents selected Mr. Milliken to be NU's new president upon the retirement of Dennis Smith. Just last month, Mr. Milliken was installed as president in ceremonies at UNO, but he held sessions and receptions at all the region's institutions across the state surrounding that event. I've asked President Milliken to make some opening remarks and then leave time at the end for questions. There are paper and pencils at each table for you to jot down questions. If you would do that, we will walk around and collect those, and then we will ask the questions from here at the podium. We will leave plenty of time at the end for that and get you out of here in a timely fashion. I am pleased to present NU President J.B. Milliken.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's great to be here today, and it's great to see so many of my colleagues here, including the head of the school in which I have a faculty appointment at UNO. So it's great to see many of my colleagues from the university here. Chris gave you a bit of a snapshot of the current state of public higher education. I don't know that Nebraska was ever free. I know it's certainly not free now. But I'm going to give you, I was asked to give you a bit of a snapshot first. I'm going to do a couple things this morning, or I guess now it's this afternoon. I'm going to give you a little bit of a snapshot of the university to make sure we all understand the environment. I'm going to talk a little bit about the role of a public university as I see it and why they are so important today, in my view, more important than ever in the history of this country. And then what some of the challenges are that we face as a state and how the university is a part of the solution, I think, to some of those challenges. The University of Nebraska now exists on four campuses. It was founded in 1869, 2 years after Nebraska became a state. in 1902, the medical center was established. In 1904, what is now the University of Nebraska at Kearney was established. And in 1906, the University of Omaha. In 1968, in the recent history, there was a merger with the University of Nebraska at that time, the Lincoln Campus and the Medical Center, with the Municipal University of Omaha, became a three-campus system. In 1991, the largest of the state colleges in the state college system became a part of the University of Nebraska at Kearney. Now we have four campuses, each with a unique mission, which I think is an important factor to keep in mind. If you were going to create a system today with four campuses to serve Nebraska, I think it would look very much like the one we have in place that the evolution has led us to. I'm the president of the university, hired by the Board of Regents. Each campus, as I think my colleagues know, is led by a chancellor. So there are four chancellors in the university. I can tell you more about some of the statistics, the number of faculty and staff, costs associated with it, if there are questions on that, but I'm going to leave that for later, because frankly that doesn't interest me as much as the broader discussion that I hope to have with you. The University of Nebraska and all public universities were created to serve their states. They are functions of the state government, essentially. They serve the people of the state through three missions, generally: teaching or instruction, research, and outreach and engagement with the people of the state. These missions haven't changed, really in 100 years in public higher education. What has changed and is changing dramatically is the way that each of these missions is achieved. It changes because of the needs of the state, because of the talent of our faculty, because of the technology that's available to us that helps and assists the way that we can deliver these resources to the state. In turn for the service in teaching and research and service that the public university owes to the state, in my view, our mission is to serve 1.7 million people in this state, and I've tried to make that point in a number of different ways. That's different than private universities, and in fact, it's different than some public universities, I think. But that is the mission of the University of Nebraska. Now, the other part of that contract, though, is that the state supports the university, and that's what keeps it public, and that's what reinforces this attitude and philosophy, I think, that the university exists to serve the state. The state supports the university primarily through tax funds, through general fund support of the university system. Universities like the University of Nebraska are supported with two primary funding sources for the core missions of the university: state tax fund and tuition. And if the state tax fund contribution to the university stagnates or goes down or doesn't keep pace with the demands that the state makes on the university, the support has to come from somewhere else. And we've seen that over the last 4 years when we've seen double-digit tuition increases at the university, which I think have had some impact on our enrollment and are certainly not the way that we would want to price the university in a perfect world. I am hopeful that this year we've had a positive budget recommendation from the governor. The revenues look like they're up for the state and will continue to be, in keeping with a general rebound in the economy nationally. And what this will allow us to do, I think, is if the state support is strong enough, we'll be able to keep tuition affordable for Nebraskans. Now, why does it matter? What's the importance of the role of the university today, and why shouldn't we take these dollars and invest them elsewhere? Well, the greatest natural resources that determined economic competitiveness used to be things like rivers and harbors and minerals. It isn't the case anymore. The greatest resource in this global economy that we're in now that determines the competitiveness and the economic strength of a region is innovation and knowledge. And universities, more than any other institution in our country, contribute to the strength, the vitality of that knowledge base and to the ability of our citizens to be innovative and to lead in this sort of global competitive market. A few years ago, the Bureau of Labor Statistics said that 85% of all new jobs created require some kind of post-secondary education or training, that it's not good enough anymore to leave with a high school education and expect to get a great job. The age of low-skill, high-wage jobs in this country is rapidly coming to an end, if it hasn't already come to an end. We see this reflected in annual earnings and lifetime earnings, depending on educational attainment level. We know now, for instance, that workers with a bachelor's degree earn over their lifetime more than $1 million more than workers with a high school degree only. So there's a significant incentive for individuals to go on to pursue higher education because of their individual earning power. But I would also argue, and I think it's becoming more and more apparent, that level of educational attainment is perhaps the most important competitive advantage for a region and a state. So not only is there individual incentive and reason to pursue higher education, there's reason for all of us to want to maximize the level of educational attainment in the state. I brought along one prop today. It's a recent publication called Innovate America. It was released within the last couple of months by the Council on Competitiveness, a national innovation initiative, which was chaired by the CEO of IBM and the president of Georgia Tech and had some of the leading university presidents and corporate CEOs in the country on the panel. It makes, I think, good but also challenging reading. We have a lot of challenges ahead of us. According to the report from this group on the Council on Competitiveness, we need a sea change in the way that our country approaches competitiveness in the global economy. It used to be, for the last 25 years, that we focused on efficiency in business and quality. But now we have to optimize, according to the Council on Competitiveness, the entire society around innovation, around increasing innovation is the only way that a country like ours is going to continue to be competitive in the world. Another source, Michael Porter, one of the leading economic development scholars in the world, puts it this way. The standard of living increases are essentially determined by productivity. And increases in productivity are determined more than any other factor by level of innovation. According to Porter, there are no low-tech and high-tech companies that exist anymore. There are only companies that are using every bit of innovative advantage, every bit of technology they can to be competitive, and there are companies that are failing. Nebraska needs to take advantage of all the resources it has to be competitive in this kind of environment, and I believe that the University of Nebraska is one of the most important resources that we have. Now, that's a challenge. But add to that some of the other challenges that Nebraska and a number of other states in the Great Plains face in particular. There was a story in the New York Times the other day about the plight of public universities, particularly in areas of the Northeast and the Great Plains, where demographic trends show a leveling out or even decline of high school graduates over the next few decades. Nebraska is one of those states. So how do we maintain and increase our competitiveness, our level of knowledge and innovation, if our supply is in some ways drying up or leveling off? Well, there are a couple of ways, and they are what I think are parts of the building blocks of a strategy for not just the university, but for the state of Nebraska. One is we need to find ways to increase the talent pool. A key way is to increase the college-going rate in Nebraska now. We enjoy one of the highest high school graduation rates in the country. I think it's number 5. That's great. But our college-going rate is dead average. Now, somewhere we're dropping off, and I don't think that's a good strategy for the state. I think we need to do things to increase that college-going rate. The percentage of adults 25 and older in Nebraska who hold a 4-year degree is below the national average. I don't think that's a way that we are going to position ourselves favorably in a knowledge economy. So we need to find ways to increase the talent pool. We need to increase the college-going rate of Nebraskans. We need to increase the number of underrepresented minorities in our universities, not just the University of Nebraska, but all. The same demographic trends that show a leveling out of the high school graduation population over the next few years also show a dramatic increase in the Hispanic population in our school systems over the next few years. That's one area where I believe we have the potential to increase our talent pool. So we increase the percentage number of Nebraskans going to college. We increase the number of underrepresented minorities who are in our colleges and universities. And there's a third strategy, I think, for the talent pool. It's one that might have been controversial a few years ago. Not sure it still is. I'll try it out, and you can tell me if it is. That's to increase the number of out-of-state students who attend our universities. Last year, the legislature had a task force, the LR-174 task force, that made recommendations about how Nebraska is going to be competitive and what needs to happen in our system of higher education to make us competitive. One of the recommendations from that commission was to increase the number of out-of-state students. So I'm not breaking new ground. What I will tell you is that I believe this is a strategy that's important for the state of Nebraska, not university enrollments. It's important because what we know about where people live and work and have families and contribute to the state infrastructure, that the highest correlation is where they receive their last degree. So if we get smart kids, and we have scholarship programs in place right now to attract the best and the brightest from surrounding states to come to Nebraska, we attract them here, they get a degree here, the likelihood that they stay and work here and contribute to the state of Nebraska is greatly increased. Okay, number one is increase the talent pool. Number two, to continue our progress in our research agenda. We've enjoyed remarkable progress over the last decade, 150% increase in our research expenditures, record numbers on all our campuses, the most dramatic being $92 million at UNL last year, $68 million at the Medical Center last year. Universities that conduct research are hubs of economic activity. You only have to look around the country to those places that are leaders in technology-based economy, whether it's Silicon Valley, Austin, Boston, Research Triangle Park in North Carolina, now increasingly Atlanta. These are areas where there's been investment in research and where there's been a dramatic impact on the local economy. It increases federal and private investment, attracts top faculty, attracts top students, and contributes more directly through tech transfer. National Science Foundation tells us, though, that every $1 million that comes in of research funding for the university generates 31 new jobs in the state. That's number two. Number three, because we aren't a large state, we aren't a wealthy state, we need to invest strategically. We need to make choices. And we need to make investments, in my view, in the programs and people and facilities that will make a difference for us. The university has been doing this over the past few years, identifying programs of excellence and priority programs on our campuses where we either are national leaders or have the opportunity for national leadership in these areas. And I think that's a valuable thing to do. We are at somewhat of a disadvantage in competing for top faculty. If you look at what has happened in the marketplace over the last generation, it used to be several thousand dollars difference in faculty salaries between the salaries paid at the large private research universities and the large publics. It's now between $20,000 and $30,000. We are, unless we do something about it, running the farm clubs for large private universities. One of the ways that we address this, I think, is by the use of private-public partnerships, by using private funds to leverage public funds. And you probably didn't see the article. I only saw it in the Lincoln paper, not the Omaha paper, but we testified a couple of days ago before the Education Committee on a proposal that we have to match private sector dollars and public sector dollars to help recruit and retain the best faculty and with distinguished chairs. What this does, in my view, is create a win-win scenario where the private sector gets to say, here's where we think you should invest. We want the best chemical engineers in America to be here, and we're going to put up the funds for a distinguished professorship. And then the state says, well, the private sector's spoken with its dollars, with its commitment of funds. What a great place to invest. So the state matches that investment. I think that's one strategy that we can adopt in Nebraska. Finally, the fourth point that I would make for a strategy for the university that is to assist the state to be vibrant is to think about a new model of engagement, a new ways to push the resources, the intellectual assets of the university outside the boundaries of our four campuses. This country pioneered that with 1862 passage of the Morrill Act and the creation of extension. Much of the reason for our leadership in production agriculture is because of the research done in our universities, which was then transferred to the field. We need to think whether that kind of model, that philosophy that underlies that, makes sense in the 21st century across the disciplines in the university. We've seen what's happened with the Peter Kiewit Institute in Omaha, with the J.D. Edwards program in Lincoln, where there have been public-private partnerships. I think that is the wave of the present. I think we need to do more of that. We need to find more ways to strengthen the university and the private sector working together. So to sum this up, because I know I now see there are a few pieces of paper, I want to talk long enough to make sure we generated a few questions. I want to try to say a few things that would connect with some of you or the opposite. Both the state of Nebraska and the University of Nebraska face significant challenges, I think. In my view, the way that the state succeeds in the 21st century, the way that our children and grandchildren have an opportunity to enjoy the same kind of life that we enjoy, is by Nebraska fully investing in the talent of its people. We cannot continue to allow what we call non-discretionary budget items in the state to continue on the trends that they're on now and to continue to shrink the availability for what we refer to as discretionary items. If we do that, we can manage these two areas in the budget over the next decade, but under current trend lines, the non-discretionaries will be at 100% and the discretionary will be at zero. And in my mind, that is a model for managing decline. That is the same as wondering about when you're going to turn the lights off. We need to have in place a strategy that invests in talent, that invests in the hope and optimism of Nebraskans, which I share, and I believe that we have the strategies that can get us to where we need to go and have a competitive, vibrant, high quality of life in Nebraska. Thanks. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Well, we got good questions. I thought we might. I'm just going to plunge in here and see how far over our heads we can get here. Should the state colleges be made a part of the University of Nebraska system?
Fortunately, that's a question I don't have to answer. I don't know the answer to that, but I'll tell you that university systems, public universities around the country are organized in very different ways. And in North Carolina, where I spent the last 6 years, all of senior public higher education was in one system. And the University of North Carolina system, 16 universities, essentially performed the role of the state colleges, the university, and the coordinating commission in Nebraska. But other states are organized differently. Of course, California has a couple of different systems, the University of California and Cal State. So there are different models, and they can all be successful. And this is this kind of governance issue, which would ultimately be decided by the the people of Nebraska, but at a minimum by the governor and the legislature, is one that that I'm not going to weigh in on because I've got a pretty big agenda as it is.
A couple of questions related to teaching and specifically to faculty, and let me just make sure that I don't have some others that I can lump in here. First of all, and one that actually has a lot of relevance right now, considering the situation in Colorado with Professor Churchill, is the tenure system for faculty still important, or has it served its purpose, and should it be replaced?
Well, I think the tenure system has served an important purpose, and I, for one, would not advocate its replacement. I do think there are experiments going on around the country which are worth taking a careful look at, and these are not experiments that are being done at fly-by-night institutions. For instance, one that was 12 miles away from where I used to live, Duke University, had a program called Professors of the Practice, where the expectations were different. They were under five-year contracts. And both the faculty who were in that program and chose that as a career opportunity seemed to be pleased with it, as were others who I think had additional teaching responsibilities freed up for research, which has become an increasingly important part of what that university does. So I think there are there are models around the country that we need to take a look at, but right now the standard practice is the tenure system and the progression in rank. And I will tell you that 2 days ago when I was testifying before the legislature, we asked a faculty member to testify also, who held a distinguished chair. And he told the members of the committee, he's a physicist, and he said, I'm going to give you an example from my own discipline. It's called inertia. And I was a full professor at the University of Michigan with a center and a robust research agenda. And by all accounts, Michigan is one of the top two or three public universities in the nation. And he said to move, to get overcome that inertia required an irresistible force. And the force in this case was a tenured, distinguished professorship at the University of Nebraska. And so this is an area, regardless of your political views on it, I will say to you that this is an area where you don't make unilateral decisions anyway.
How does your present faculty feel about your goal to get, as you called it, better faculty?
I want a show of hands on which of the faculty members wrote that question. I have yet to talk to a faculty member whom I know and respect that is doing good work at the University of Nebraska that has argued that point with me. It starts, in my view, with an underlying philosophy that the difference between mediocre universities and great universities is the quality of the faculty. And I believe that we need high-quality faculty across the disciplines, across our four campuses. One way that we can build national identity, that we can be leaders in areas that we choose to be national leaders in, is to be as competitive as possible for the best faculty in that field, regardless of where they currently live and teach and do research. So not everyone is going to hold a distinguished chair. I think it's an important competitive strategy for Nebraska, but it's also one that is going to enrich each of our campuses and, I believe, benefit faculty across the university. It doesn't take the place of appropriate and competitive salary levels for current faculty, and I'm pleased to see that for the first time in a few years, it looks like some positive sign at the state for faculty salaries. But I do think it's an important part of our strategy, and one, again, where if we didn't have something like this in place, we'd be one of the only places that didn't have it in place.
In your view, what is the role of the liberal arts in this new technological age? Is it still the core of the university?
Well, I am an English major, and I believe strongly in the liberal arts. And the other day, in connection with the installation activities that Chris mentioned, we had a panel discussion on the future of public higher education with four university presidents, and Linda Pratt, an English professor on the Lincoln campus, who also is the former national president of the AUP. And I asked that question of Linda, is there a place for the liberal arts, and what do your faculty think when they hear me or Molly Broad or Graham Spanier or the other people on stage talking about the connection with the economy? Linda and I agree that there is a future for the liberal arts, and they still are the core of the institution. There's no question that when I talk with business leaders and others who are hiring our graduates, that the most important thing to them is not the grade point average of a student, but it is, do they have the skills required? Can they communicate? Can they work well with others? Do they read and write clearly? These are all skills, I think, that are embedded in the liberal arts, and I think are going to continue to be a critical part of every university in this country.
Do you have any ideas for developing a university K-12 partnership to increase the number of college-bound students?
I do. We are reinvigorating the Nebraska P-16, pre-K 16 initiative. I have had meetings with Doug Christensen, Commissioner of Education, and other K-12 leaders. I believe that is a critical partnership. I came from a place in North Carolina where they developed an entire division of the university around public school and university linkages, with continuing education programs, principal training and superintendent training programs, residential programs for K-12 teachers and administrators. I don't know that we're at that point in Nebraska, but I do think this notion of increasing the college going rate, of increasing the number of underrepresented minorities who attend our universities, is the only way that we can achieve that is with a partnership of pre-K 16. One of the things that I think it needs to be at the top of the agenda is how we provide information across the state, both financial information and preparedness, academic preparedness information, at appropriate levels, middle school and below, so that students and their parents know that they can attend college and what's available, and they know what to do to prepare to attend. And we can't be effective in doing that without a partnership with our colleagues in K-12.
This one asks really for you to solve sort of a conundrum. 1964 saw the beginning of the largest college classes with the baby boomers, when the baby boomers hit. Huge increases in enrollment. College was funded by Depression-era and war-depleted generations, small in numbers, and yet money was plentiful. 2004, 2005, relatively smaller classes in college, funded by a huge pool of baby boomers who were at the peak of their earning years, and money is short. What happened?
I think you ought to look at the growth in Medicaid and in corrections and, frankly, in K-12 spending, which I certainly do not begrudge and I support. And it's critically important that those increases have occurred in K-12. But it part of this boils down to what our society thinks it needs to do as a society and what's important. And the costs that are associated with those. It's not that state budgets have decreased. It's that the non-discretionary items in state budgets have increased often at two or three times the rate of the total state budget. So it doesn't take long before that eats most of the budget. I heard the chairman of the Appropriations Committee speak yesterday at a lunch and say that if the state budget has grown at about 5%, a year, and Medicaid's growing at about 10% a year. Well, when it is 20 or 30% of the size of the budget, it doesn't take very long before that pushes everything else out. And I think that's the critical difference, both at the federal level and at the state level. And that is an issue that we have to grapple with nationally and in Nebraska, or we are not going to be able to make the investments we need to in things like higher education.
Name, if you would, some areas where the University of Nebraska has particular expertise. What would you like to see?
Okay. I assume that what I would like to see relates to areas of expertise. There are strengths on all of our campuses, and they're different. And that's one of the, in fact, that's one of the great things about the system. Go to Kearney, they have, an excellent honors program and service learning program for undergraduates. It's essentially a residential, undergraduate-focused campus, and they do many things very well, provide a fabulous undergraduate education in chemistry, political science, and other areas. So those are some areas where, if I were looking at programs of excellence in the university and in Kearney, I would look to. The medical center in Omaha has identified a number, about eight, I think, priority areas where they excel, soft tissue transplant, cancer research, and others, where we are and I think can continue to be among the national leaders. In Lincoln, the university has an increasing level of accomplishment and recognition in areas in chemical engineering, nanotechnology, has had strong, very strong agriculture programs, plant pathology, plant science, water resources, has the premier Willa-Cather program in the world, which it ought to. In Omaha, at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, I'll start with the obvious, and then which everyone talks about, the Peter Kiewit Institute and the new College of Information Science, Technology, and Engineering, which is a wonderful new public-private model and one that is very accomplished. But in deference to my colleagues in the room, I promise you I would say this even if you weren't here, but other areas where we're nationally ranked in public affairs, public administration, criminal justice, social work, the Goodrich program. Not sure I would have said that, Jerry, if I didn't know you were in the room. But, yeah, no, those are areas of excellence at UNO. And so every campus, this is the important thing, is that the campuses and the faculty and the academic administrators on the campus work together to identify what those areas are, where the strengths are, and where we think, and this is where pressure comes from me a little bit, I think, where we think the needs of Nebraska and the nation and match up with some of those strengths and where we ought to be investing more and more.
What do you see as the future of distance education?
In a place like Nebraska, distance education is critical, where we've got 1.7 million people spread over 450 miles of state and where the population centers are concentrated. I think it's critically important that we offer more distance education than we offer today. I want to be in a position where people in Nebraska have the opportunity to pursue continuing education or matriculate through distance education, and we compete effectively with Phoenix University, the National Technological University, and others who are leaders in this area. But we compete on the basis of quality, that Nebraskans and others, because there are no barriers anymore in offering an education over the internet, that people identify with the University of Nebraska, and that we attract students through our distance programs, not just through price, but also through quality. And I think that's a competitive battle we can win in the state of Nebraska, and that we ought to be winning. It is going to be more and more a larger share of the college-going population, and certainly the continuing education population. And career training is going to be more and more dependent on distance learning, and we need to be a part of that.
You make a great argument, and you have several times, for the economic benefits of higher education. What are some of the non-economic benefits, personal, spiritual, emotional, cultural, some of those benefits of a liberal arts education?
Well, the economic benefits are important. The ability to earn a better living, critically important. And I think when we know that the difference between the ability to earn X and X plus or X times 2 is degree of educational attainment, and we hold the keys to that better quality of life, that's not just some abstract discussion about the economic importance of education or economic development. That is perhaps the most fundamental difference you can make in someone's lives. So when you look at it on an individual basis, I make no apologies for the economic impact of education. I think it is the best thing that we can offer people in this country. But if you want to move it out of the economic realm, I think the single most important value of education is it enables us to run an effective and enlightened democracy. If we are going to have an effective system of governing ourselves, then I think we have an obligation to provide education to the people who are running this country, to the voters. And I think education is the key to an enlightened democracy. You look around the world at experiments with democracy and see those that are successful and those that aren't. I think education is a critical component of that. And it goes far beyond that. I think the ability to enjoy a life, at least in my own case, is largely related to a liberal arts education. What I like to read and do and think about now is I can trace to my years as an undergraduate at the University of Nebraska. Two nights ago, I was on stage before 1,200 people with the U.S. Poet Laureate talking about poetry and the creative activity. And I think some of my former faculty members were in the room, and they were probably embarrassed by me saying that I could trace my own level of understanding to my undergraduate days, but I did anyway. But I don't. I think it is impossible to underestimate the transformational power of education, whether it's in your personal life or with regard to the democracy and society.
Can you comment on President Bush's promises to increase Pell Grants, and do you feel this will have a positive impact on recruitment of minority students?
Well, I have to start with a caveat. I have not read the president's budget proposal. Usually it's a document that's several thousand pages thick, and so the second confession is I've never read a president's budget recommendations. I did see on television news the other night that there were four main areas targeted for cuts, and if I were making the choices, I'm not sure that I would put agriculture and education in the top four areas targeted for cuts. there will be a significant impact on the University of Nebraska and the state of Nebraska with regard to the agriculture cuts. Both university research, which I am told is slated for cuts through the Department of Agriculture, and the state. And in education, I am pleased that there is a target to increase the amount of Pell Grants, and I hope that we can find the funds to appropriate funds to fully match the authorized level of Pell Grants, which hasn't been done in recent years. So the President and the Congress need to work together first to find a way to meet the currently authorized level, and if we're going to increase it, the challenge is going to be the funding for it, not the authorization of it. I am disappointed to see the demise of the Perkins Loan program, which I think currently provides assistance to underrepresented minorities and students who have extra financial need. So we'll have to see how this shakes out. It is a long ways from being final in terms of how the higher education component of the budget will shake out. But there are some highlights, and there, I think, are also some problems with it.
A majority of Americans now call themselves conservative, but a majority of university personnel, professors, I assume, call themselves liberal. Does this indicate universities are out of touch with the real world?
I imagine those faculty are using a much more traditional definition of the word liberal, which, and in fact, probably means that they're conservative. Let me say another way. Let's not look at the individual. Let's look at the institution. Universities are the most conservative institutions in our culture, I think. Among the hardest to bring change to, and it seems to me that ought to be a definition of conservative or of liberal, whichever definition you're using. It's hard for me to comment on that. I see in the media the claim that faculty are much more liberal than the general population. I also see numbers that show that students are considerably more conservative than their faculty. So if people are worried about the level of influence, it doesn't seem to be taking. In fact, maybe this is with the growth. I haven't gone back and read Kevin Phillips' book from the 60s in a long time about the new majority, but perhaps this was one of the strategies, that we have a more and more liberal faculty and that'll generate a more and more conservative alumni base. So,
well, continuing in that vein, and this question is prompted by the case in Colorado where Professor Churchill, and I've forgotten his first name, in a speech made some remarks about the victims of 9/11, and the Board of Regents there has voted to have him investigated. If Professor Churchill were on your faculty, how would you handle the situation, free speech versus responsibility? There's a speculation question. Take all the time you want.
Well, first of all, I hate to pick on Colorado because they have a lot of problems right now. And even if you get away from football, they have made some policy choices in the last few years that I think are disastrous for higher education and for progress in the state. But that's what they chose to do. I'm really going to have to say that I know less about this issue than the questioner. In fact, I just became aware of this in the last few days. My basic reaction to it is while the news reports of Professor Churchill's comments, I think, indicate a set of deplorable statements. Having said that, I believe that we have to, in this country, maintain an environment where there is freedom of speech and expression that doesn't have a consequence of losing one's job. I don't agree with it, and I think the—I mean, I don't agree with his statements. But I think—I mean, you go back to Oliver Wendell Holmes. The best way to challenge bad ideas is in the marketplace of ideas. You allow good ideas and truth ultimately to triumph over bad ideas and falsehood. And if you suppress it and you don't have an expression and a healthy debate, then I think you have created a set of problems that is far worse. I think that the reaction to those comments is understandable, and I share it. But bad ideas ultimately lose to good ideas, and lies lose to truth.
What do you think of the ratings that various publications use with regard to colleges and universities across the country?
I should have taken longer with my initial comments and provided less time for questions and answers. Well, I think that U.S. News and World Report has done very well for itself. They have an economic strategy that saved their magazine, I think, and it is rating colleges. I don't put a huge amount of stock in U.S. News and World Report ratings of colleges. I think most ratings, not only theirs, but also much more reputable ratings that, or I shouldn't say reputable, but more broadly accepted in the academic establishment, like the National Research Council's decennial rankings of graduate programs. You know, those have a reputational component, which is pretty significant. So all rating systems are based, they're subjective in part. And you can, I think, pull apart the 28 or 30 or however many fields of data there are in the U.S. News and World Report and find problems where it's difficult to compare one institution with another. But we do know that students and their parents and the news media pay attention to U.S. News and World Report and other ranking systems. They're here to stay, and all of us are in an environment where we have to pay some attention to those. I think there are other measures that are better. In recent years, there has been a nationally established survey of student engagement, which is done for undergraduates and recent alums to test by survey method the quality of an education that a student receives. I think those are probably better measures than the kinds of things we see in U.S. News. But again, we're not going to unilaterally disarm. We are going to pay some attention to them, and I'm afraid I don't have a choice in that matter.
All right. One last question, and what we in the media call a softball question. You knew it had to come. How much damage has been done to the NU budget by the failed football program? Only a couple of TV games and no bowl games, and any chance of getting rid of Peterson and Callahan?
That was a softball? First of all, I don't think there has been any harm done to the publicly supported budget of the university. It's a matter of some debate nationally, the relationship between athletic performance and private fundraising and admissions. The Knight Commission recently came out with a report, the conclusion of which is that there is no correlation between athletic performance and revenue in a university. I think anecdotally I might give you a somewhat different conclusion. When you win national championships, people tend to feel good about it, but I don't think there's been any public negative reaction in terms of public funding. We have the Huskers, one of my three football teams, is reported to have one of the top five recruiting classes in the country. So, you know, I think that the view of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's football fortunes is considerably brighter around the rest of the country than it is in on the 22nd floor in Omaha, because we have some of the best high school football players in the country coming because they want to be a part of the program. So I think it bodes well for the future. And frankly, I think the two fellas you mentioned at the end of that question are largely responsible for a lot of that recruiting success.
Well, I wish we had more time, because we do have some other questions, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them. Before we adjourn, I'd like to mention a couple of things. The next Press Club Forum will be on Thursday, March 24th. The panel guests will be local veterans of the war in Iraq from the Nebraska National Guard and from the Army Reserve. They'll present their personal reflections of service in Iraq, and, of course, audience members will have the opportunity to ask questions of the veterans. The Press Club Forum is at noon, Thursday, March 24th. You can call the Press Club to make your reservations, and the $12 cost includes the forum and lunch, and also to have your parking validated. The noon forums are available to purchase on videotape through CP Media. You can call 1-800-227-5281, or you can call the Press Club if you'd like a copy. I'd like to thank our guest today, NU President Dr. J.B. Milliken. I'd also like to thank KIOS Radio for airing the Omaha Press Club Forums, and I think this Press Club Forum will be at noon tomorrow. We are adjourned. Thank you all.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's speaker was James Milliken, newly appointed president of the University of Nebraska. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, February 10th, 2005, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Chris Allen for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future forums in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.